I'm up on the tight wire.
I'm here in Studio B, sitting next to my good friend, Daniel Chacon.
And I'm sitting by my good friend, Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Today we have a very exciting show. We have Maceo Montoya, who is the brother of my very good friend, now deceased, Andres Montoya. And he is an incredible visual artist and a wonderful writer. And he had a new book just came out. It's called The Deportation of Whopper Barraza. And we're going to talk to him about that and about being part of what Andres and I used to jokingly call Chicano royalty, the Montoya clan.
It's going to be a great interview. It really is. I'm really looking forward to it.
He's also going to read the poem of the week, which is a poem by his brother called The Ice Worker Sings.
And our poetic license is going to come from where, Daniel?
From Joseph Rios, who is a young, brilliant Chicano writer from Fresno, I believe, originally, although he's basically been hanging out in Berkeley with Javier Huerta for the last several years. Brilliant young man, and he's going to share some words with us.
Well, it's going to be a really, really good show. But since, you know, because Maceo's an artist, I'm thinking about art right now. Who are some of your favorite artists, Daniel?
Ooh, that's a tough one. You know, I love certain periods of Picasso. You know, I love Goya's.
You know, I love visual art. I kind of wanted to be an artist. But, you know, I needed to write more than I needed to paint. But, you know, I really love art very much. And I love Van Gogh. And I love Frida Kahlo. And there are so many paintings that I so admire, you know. And I love, you know, Hopper.
Oh, yeah.
I love his darkness.
Absolutely.
You know, his people are more like still lifes than they are people,
right,
in certain ways. But they're so wonderful and dark. But there's something very compelling about his work, which I really love. And I don't know. I remember going to the Louvre and seeing the Raft of the Medusa. And I remember seeing the Mona Lisa. And I just remember walking around. And at that time, when I went to the Louvre, the Jeu de Paume was still there. It's no longer there. It was a separate museum for all of the French Impressionists. They had one little museum.
Right now, it's d'Orsay. All that stuff is in the d'Orsay.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But the Jeu de Paume was wonderful. And I remember going to El Prado. And then I remember going to Toledo and seeing Goya's and Velázquez's. And I just, the whole idea of telling a story through a painting, not that you have to.
Right, right.
Not that you have to. All paintings are not narrative. I love Picasso. If you see Picasso, you know, you see his drawings or small paintings when he was practically still a boy. He was a master.
Oh, yeah.
Already.
He was doing realistic, almost, you know, you would think there were photographs. They were so incredibly, he knew how to do it before he started to. I tell my students that a lot. They want to write like abstract, you know, before they learn the form.
And of course, I love Matisse.
And you know what's interesting is the two forms of painting that are original from the United States, that grew out of the United States, abstract painting and hyperrealism. I went through my stages when I was just so fascinated by hyperrealism. You know, I mean, these are paintings that really look like photographs, but it's kind of interesting because they don't really say much. They're just kind of like, here's an image, here's a photograph, and I'm going to show you how talented I am and how skilled I am, and I'm going to represent it. And, you know, it started as an American form of painting, which makes sense because a lot of it is about restaurants. You'll see a ketchup bottle, or you'll see, you know, these products in the windows. And then the other one is abstract painting. And I'm starting to get into abstract painting more and more. A good abstract painting has a emotional complexity for me that that maybe I didn't understand when I first started looking at paintings. I thought, oh, anyone can do that. But now I say, oh, no, not very many people can do that.
I have a couple of paintings that people ask that seem like they're abstracts and they're not. What I do is I focus in on a certain part of something real and I paint that piece of it or I draw that piece of it. And it seems to be abstract art when in fact it isn't, which is really interesting.
Wow. Well, I'm really excited because we'll just ask him a lot about paintings because this guy is a master painter, young man. And even though he's, you know, I don't know exactly how old he is, and of course I won't ask him, but he's an assistant professor now at UC Davis. But he looks so young that his students look older than he does. He looks like a little kid.
I used to look like that. Stay tuned for our interview with Maceo Montoya, Words on a Wire.
Paseo Montoya grew up in Elmira, California. He comes from a family of artists, including his father, Malaquias Montoya, a renowned artist, activist, and educator, and his late brother, my very good friend, Andres Montoya, whose poetry collection, The Ice Worker Sings and Other Poems, won the American Book Award in 2000. Maceo graduated from Yale in 2002 and received his MFA from Columbia University in painting in 2006. His paintings and drawings have been featured in exhibitions all over the world, and he has been called by Latino Stories one of the top 10 new Latino writers to watch. And his new book just came out, The Deportation of Whopper Barraza. Maceo Montoya, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Oh, thank you, Daniel.
We should probably change the name of the show to the Montoya Show, because we just had your cousin Richard on the other day, and then we always have the Andres Montoya Poetry Prize winners, who was your brother. Andres was your brother. So we're like, this is like the Montoya radio show.
That's great.
Before we get into your new book, The Deportation of Whopper Barraza, which I read in manuscript form and think it's a fantastic book, let's talk a little bit about, I think our listeners would be really interested in the family that you come from, the Montoyas. Your father is Malaquias Montoya, who is certainly, you know, one of the most important Chicano artists, you know, in the history of Chicano art, I would say. He kind of revitalized and contributed to defining the entire poster art movement and Chicano art movement. And then you have your uncle, Jose Montoya, who, well, godfather of Chicano poetry, great artist, founder of the RCAF, and then Richard Montoya, who is the founder of Culture Clash and now just has a new movie coming out. And then, my gosh, and then you. This is ridiculous. What was it like coming from a family like that?
Well, I guess I've always known just how special and how lucky I am to be a part of this family. And my main, I guess, creative relationship has been with my dad as my mentor, and principally just with my artwork and whether it was just drawing lessons, but more just the example of what one can do with the artwork. And both my dad and my uncle, Jose, became artists along with the Chicano movement. And so there was always this idea that art, their visual work, their poetry, my tio Jose was also a musician, served a social function. And so I was always aware of that. And then, of course, there's my brother Andres, the poet. And I think that when he passed away, and just kind of sorting through his life and reading through his words, and that had a big impact on my development as an artist. But you'd be surprised, even though coming from a family of artists, we don't sit around and talk about art. My conversations with my uncle, were few when it comes to anything regarding literature or visual work, but I guess just being surrounded by it and knowing who these figures were and the importance that they had in their community. And only recently have Richard and I kind of dialogued just about the challenges that are out there facing an artist. And so that's been really, really important. And there's also my cousin Tomas, I should mention, Richard's younger brother, who's an artist, and we're the same age. And we've gone on trips together, and we've continued a dialogue for many years. And so I guess just having that, you know, I just have always realized just how special that is to feel like you're a part of something greater, whether it's your family or even just the community that you're part of. That's always been a fundamental part of my artwork, my visual work, and also my writing.
You know, because you're both a painter and a writer. And unlike me, I'm also a painter, but I'm not a painter like you're a painter. You studied at Columbia?
Yeah, I got my MFA.
You got your MFA in visual arts at Columbia University. And did you have the idea that you were going to be a writer and an artist the whole way through, or how did that happen?
I didn't. I began as a visual artist, as a painter, and I had an idea that I enjoyed writing, or more so I just enjoyed stories and storytelling. And so my paintings were always very narrative. And I became a painter through working on murals. And of course there's a strong story tied to muralism, whether it's a religious message or a political message, or there's always some story in there. You know, look at the Mexican muralists, and you know, they're telling the whole history of Mexico and very narrative driven. And so when I started my own murals, you know, there was always that story involved. But it wasn't until I moved to Knight's Landing, which is a small town close to Woodland, maybe about 10, 15 miles away, and this was after I graduated from college. And I had this idea that I just wanted to hole up in a room and paint. I knew how to draw. I was always, you know, I felt like I had some skill there, but I wanted to teach myself how to paint. And so I rented a room in this little town and set up my easel and just started to work. And the first couple of paintings that I worked on, I would show to whether it's the woman whose house I rented the room from. I played soccer across the street with all these guys that were from Michoacan. And, you know, they were just curious what I was doing in this little town. And so I'd show them my work. And I found that they had all these stories that they wanted to tell because they recognized the figures in my painting. And the stories were fascinating. They provided details that weren't in the painting. And I wanted to capture those somehow. And so it began just as a feeling that not that the painting was unsuccessful, but that it lacked something somehow. And rather than trying to place it in the painting, which I would do or eventually become more adept at doing, but I started to write those details down. And they started as long, elaborate titles, and then it became vignettes and then short stories. And as soon as that started to take hold, I knew that it was this dual project. You know, what the painting alone wasn't enough, that the writing somehow satisfied this larger vision that I had. Then it became very exciting. That was my first attempt at a novel, was The Dreams of Juan Jose and Other Stories of Knight's Landing. And it was about 50 paintings. It was a very productive year, and then the accompanying stories. And so it was very exciting time for me to figure that out. And it wasn't until later, after that project, that I kind of realized that I had to, my development as a writer and my development as an artist kind of had to take their own course. I had to become, I think, a better writer. Also, you know, to continue develop as a painter. And so they took separate tracks after that.
You know, it's like you're the opposite of me. It took me, because I didn't study painting, and as an artist, I had to, you know, paint a long time and work at it and work at it and work at it until my skills caught up with my imagination. And I think that, does that feel that way for your writing? That somehow your skills had to catch up with your imagination as you learned to write?
Sort of. For me, it was more, I knew that even, you know, when I was younger with the painting, with the visual work, that, you know, even if it wasn't as skillful, say, as my later work, you know, more trained, there was still like a feeling that I knew I was able to capture, and I knew it. And I would look at the work and I would feel like whatever I had inside is there. And now I look at those early works and, you know, I'm embarrassed by some of the technical aspects, but at least there's that feeling. And that was the hardest thing for me in writing, was it wasn't as obvious. I was searching in the dark, really. And that took years. You know, I would plug away and work very hard at trying to make these stories successful. But there was that feeling was always elusive. And to be honest, you know, it remains the case. I think it's less accessible, and I've improved as a writer, and I feel much more confident about my work. But when it comes to actually capturing that feeling, I'm much more confident when it comes to the visual work than I am to the written. You know, yet it doesn't bother me necessarily. I love how difficult it is to find that feeling in writing, whereas with the visual work, it's a nice break just to, you know, that guttural feeling, knowing that I can let it out, that it'll merge somehow onto the paper or onto the canvas.
We're talking to Maceo Montoya, artist and writer, whose new book, The Deportation of Whopper Barraza, just came out, which is really a very funny book in many ways, about a guy who is completely immersed in the culture of Northern California, gets deported because he's not a citizen, and suddenly finds himself not really speaking Spanish very well and living in Mexico. Wonderful premise. I'm looking at your webpage, maceomontoya.com, and you have a gallery, and it has some of your paintings and your drawings, and they're just beautiful. I mean, they're just, you're a fantastic painter. But one of the things I'm noticing is that your painting not only reflects a region, Knight's Landing, Woodland, the farm workers in Northern California, but it also tells a story. Even the images tell a story, and it's as if the story itself just needs to be, you just need to express the story of the people that you met and the people that you're around. I'm looking at one right now called The Cruel Violence of Families. And it looks like there was a birthday party, probably for a child, because there's balloons. But there was a fight, and we're seeing the aftermath of the fight, or right when the fight is broken up. And in the background, you see the grain silos, and it's all very gray, and it's all very dark. The kids are, like, you know, hiding in the background. So it's like you were telling stories even when you were painting.
Definitely. And one thing that I found with my painting is that it would emerge, I guess, darker or more somber. And my writing, whenever I sat down to write these stories, they'd come out lighthearted or more humorous. And that, like, I definitely feel like I get from my family. You know, if you were to look at my father, Malaquias Montoya's work, it's very dark, it's very harsh, it's very blunt. And yet, my dad is a very funny man and
tells right.
wonderful stories. You know, I grew up with him as a disciplinarian and very, you know, not necessarily strict, but, you know, he had high expectations for how he wanted his children to be and act and respond to the world. And yet, you know, every time he tells a story, it's with the intention of making someone laugh. And then, of course, Mateo Jose, his poetry and his storytelling, it was all just locura, craziness, and telling a story, entertaining. So I think that I inherited that, definitely. And it came out more naturally, I think, in my writing, this desire to, you know, tell these difficult stories, these very, very, very hard, you know, realities of life, but to also to entertain and to make people laugh. And I think that those are the stories that I respond to. The authors whose work I admire, it's always because, you know, I'm laughing out loud and I'm just so curious. How do they do that? How do they recreate that moment so that someone, you know, however many years later, picks up a book and laughs out loud? So to me, that's a fascinating aspect of storytelling. Whereas with the painting, as you described, that scene, you know, it's a dark, somber. But at the same time, you know, I think that there's humorous aspects of that piece. The balloons, the piñata that's in the corner, the old viejito who's could care less that there's this huge fight, this brawl that's going on at the family party. And it's just, I think, more subtle, and it's more about the tone than anything
yeah.
else.
We're running short of time here, so we want to talk about The Deportation of Barbara Barraza, your book that just came out from University of New Mexico Press. Tell us first about Whopper Barraza. Where did you get a name like that?
Well, The Deportation of Whopper Barraza, the story that the novel is based on, is a woodland story. And a friend of a friend, his brother, after getting his fourth DUI, was deported to Mexico. And the only place he knew to go was his parents' hometown, this rancho in the middle of Michoacan. And when I heard that story, it was just so fascinating to me because he hadn't been to Mexico since he was 3 or 4 years old, and he just had to figure it out. And that guy actually ended up raising sheep or mm-hmm. some sort of livestock there. And it was just something that I continued to think about, and I wanted to. It started as a short story. And it wasn't until I got to how to develop the story that these other characters emerged. But as far as the name, there's a guy in Woodland named Whopper. he told me his story at the gym once, and I just cracked up. And he told me, I always like to eat. And he's a big guy. And he was going to a soccer tournament, and his dad, before they went to the soccer tournament, decided to buy the whole team Whoppers when they're only a dollar each in the back seat with him. And by the time they got to the tournament, which was about 2 hours away, he'd eaten all of the Whoppers. And so the father announces, I got lunch for everyone, and all he found in the bag were the wrappings. Of course, Whopper, he ended up pretty sick and not able to play. And so I just thought, well, I mean, for one, there's nothing more, you know, they have this American idea of the Burger King Whopper. And I actually had to change that story just because not wanting to get into trouble with Burger King Corporation. But it's more or less that's the story that's in the book.
That's fantastic. It's a great book. It's humorous. It's poignant. And we highly recommend it. I hope it does well. Good luck on that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Maceo, thank you for being on our show today, Words on a Wire. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, no, for me too. Thank you both.
This week, our poem of the week comes from Andres Montoya, The Ice Worker Sings. And his brother, Maceo, who we just interviewed, is going to read it.
It didn't matter to him that it was only seasonal, or that he had no choice but the graveyard shift. A job in the ice plant in the hot Fresno summer was as close as he'd get to heaven. Or at least, this is what he thought. He liked his job because they let him alone. Here, everyone wore earplugs, and he was left in a room by himself to stack blocks of ice into rows of crystal perfection. Rows and rows, a huge army of petrified water standing at attention. He found himself marching back and forth, singing songs he never knew he loved. Sometimes he would sing rock or blues or even a classical tune he'd heard on a bad radio commercial. But mostly, he would steal the beat and put in his own words about life, about love, about dying. This is how he became a poet, parting ways with the sad ocean of ordinary speech. He sang loud, and he liked it. No one ever told him to shut up or that he couldn't carry a tune. He enjoyed singing, seeing song spring from between his lips in the white breath of the cold room. He found he could forget everything while he sang among the ice, the house that kept shedding shingles, the mad-dogging eyes that followed him to work, and his cowardice under the yellow street lamps, while he knelt on the pot road of potholes and gravel and dust, begging the moon to release him from his fear of everything. But here he sang, and his army of ice to him were warriors from Tula, big, square warriors, sympathetic to the orders of their general, which was, of course, him. They laughed when he laughed, and cried when he cried. Only here, he never cried. He didn't have to. At home, his mother slept with the windows open in hope the breeze would finally blow. At home, they didn't have refrigeration. At home, even the walls were hot. On breaks, he would sit outside on the bench to smoke and drink coffee. Here, he would pray for his mother, pray for angels to come carrying machine guns and flamethrowers to keep watch over her. He would pray for wind so that she, like him, might escape the hell of Fresno in the summer. And when the break was over, he would go back to the ice and give life to his army. He would go back to the ice and sing.
Thank you, Maceo, for reading your brother Andres's poem, The Ice Worker Sings.
Thank you.
My name is Joseph Rios. I'm from the San Joaquin Valley in Central California. As a poet and student of literature, I'm preoccupied with the history of Fresno as a hub for poetry and as the homeland of my family for over a century. I think of this piece as a movement toward an answer to the big question, why Fresno? Much more could be said about this, and much more needs to be written about this. I am indebted to the interviews with Levine, prose works by Levis, and an article by Rigoberto Gonzalez, which appeared in a 2008 issue of In the Grove. I recently spent some time in Los Angeles with friends, many of them transplants from Fresno too. On my drive back up north, I picked up my friend, author Michelle Cerros, from her beloved Oxnard. I told her about the piece while driving on the 101 North. Michelle, ever the mentor, and a seasoned writer for TV and radio in her own right, suggested I record the piece out in a field somewhere, somewhere off the side of the freeway. That's where it comes from, right? She said. So we did that. With the sun going down, dark clouds overhead, in the rain, my boots and her little gold shoes caked with mud, I recorded this piece somewhere near Salinas or maybe Gilroy. I hope you enjoy. And on the road, Jack Kerouac said of Fresno, yes, yes, Saroyan's town. Contrary to popular opinion, Fresno is the middle of everywhere. I'm from there. A lot of other poets and writers are from there. Bigger names than mine. Names like Levine, Levis, Soto, Herrera, Buckley, Salinas, St. John, and even the host of this program, Chacon. Like many other Fresno writers of my generation, I live away from the place I preach about and write about so often. See, we were made to believe in our formative years that if we wanted to succeed in anything, we'd have to get out of Fresno. We'd have to head north to San Francisco, over the car-killing grapevine to Los Angeles, or to any other great length beyond the borders of our state to find what the San Joaquin Valley most certainly lacked. Though it is in our leaving, and only in our leaving, that we discover, yes, there is indeed a wide world outside the valley. But we also learn that while Fresno is lacking in some mystic element that must be sought elsewhere, we find that there is something all these other places lack, something we long for when we leave, something we always return to, come back for, something that appears in our poems, there where we interrogate our center, we, those few who call the valley home, find that our collective beginning is at the middle. Our beginning is a middle. Our center is the center, the middle of everywhere. So as I continue to find more and more poets and other artists from the valley scattered about this state and beyond, I can't help but ask myself, why? Why does our home turn out so many poets? What makes it such fertile ground for poetry and produce? Is it the summers that burst our radiator caps and burn our hands through torn t-shirts? Or the winters that keep our belts screeching, keep us holding on to that one winter we had snow and not just the fog? Is it because no matter where you are in the city or how many federal, state, and international buildings surround you, you are no less than 10 minutes away from a wide expanse of crop, fields, and space? Is it because we can still see the stars there? Because on a clear day, we have a view of the Sierras? Is it because we are the doorstep to both Yosemite and Kings Canyon National Parks? Or is it because we keep our homeless out of Chinatown with bulldozer shovels? Is it because we have some of the highest concentrated poverty in the country? Most car thefts and break-ins, one of the most heavy-handed police forces in the state? Is it because penitentiaries outnumber universities in our region? Is it because our fathers die of liver diseases? Because our brothers tattoo dog paws on their faces? Should we blame the polluted air we breathe, the tinted water we drink? Shall we blame the smog that floats in from San Francisco and the perpetual traffic jam that is LA? Should we blame the Armenians, the Serbians, the Cambodians, the Salvadorans, and the Hmong? Shall we blame them for seeking refuge there? What about the Japanese interned in Pinedale? What of the Nazi POWs sent to work alongside Mexicans in Madera? What place have they in our songs? The truth is, we of the San Joaquin Valley and of Fresno County are the same space above Half Dome, and we are the cavernous gardens below Shaw 99. We are the ancient marshlands and the concrete dams that dried them up. We are Gallo Wine and Security Bank, Kalwa and River Park. Between gangsters wearing colors and badges, we are the bullets that feed hungry mouths, the steel that shackles the children. We are the peaches and the president's fruit salad. We are oleander bushes blooming pink and poisonous. We are tent cities and track home sprawls. We are Nordstrom Rack and Cafe Corazon. We are fourth generation Chicano, first generation from Laos. We are no city. We are no town. We are no town.
For Words on a Wire, I'm Joseph Rios.
Well, another day, another show. That was just wonderful.
We'd like to thank Maceo Montoya for talking about his paintings and his wonderful new book, The Deportation of Whopper Barraza. And thank you for reading the poem, Maceo, Ice Worker Sings, and Joseph Rios. That was amazing. Thank you for doing a poetic license.
And we'd like to thank again and again and again our producer, Norma Martinez. Where would we be without her? Join us again next week for another edition of Words on a Wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And don't forget,
the next book you read
could save your life.
I'm up on Taiwan.